relativistically accelerated particle detectors. Okay? And as we've seen a few times today, when we have a relativistically accelerated particle detector, it sees a thermal bath, it's known as the Unruh effect, at a temperature T that's proportional to A. So an accelerated detector in the vacuum will begin detecting particles when it is accelerating with relativistic speeds. Okay, so this thermal bath is a sort of noise that we can view it as a certain type of noise. And we know that this thermal noise in a quantum system can lead to errors. And this is sort of a problem. And as we have accelerated detectors and we know that they see a thermal bath, this could introduce noise, and we don't really know how this will affect what happens. But is this always a bad thing? Could we somehow exploit this noise to perform quantum operations on a single qubit? That's the question I'm going to address today. And so what I have on the left here is a state in the Bloch sphere that we're going to take and provide accelerations for certain times and try to slowly iterate it through the Bloch sphere and see what points we can get to. And this is fairly general. We could consider sort of general relativistic paths through curved spacetime, but today we'll just consider a particle detector in a cavity. Okay, now what's the motivation for this? Way back when, we were making transistors, and every few years we tried to make them smaller and smaller and smaller, and eventually we began getting tunneling effects between the wires on those transistors. And this led to noise, quantum noise, sort of tunneling between the wires. But then we started using sort of quantum effects to come up with ideas for quantum computers. And these quantum effects turned out to be very useful, sometimes beating classical computers. Now, are these relativistic effects always going to be noise? Could we somehow exploit this so that we can use it to our advantage? What's the model that we're using? Well, first inertially, we looked at a detector inside a cavity interacting with every mode of the field. We had some parameters to play with. That's the length of the cavity, which controls the spacing in the modes, the time of evolution that we looked at, and the energy gap in the detector omega. And so what happens is there'll be one mode that the big omega is in resonance with. That would be omega 2 in this case. And we can somehow shift that by playing with the different parameters, and this will let it interact mostly with that mode, and it will see the rest of the modes, but most of the evolution will be caused by this single omega here. Now what happens when we accelerate this detector? So we have this detector inside this cavity, and we accelerate it down. Now all of the parameters that we get to play with are the exact same, the length of the cavity and the time of evolution, but instead of the detector seeing just these being in resonance with just one mode, we see that it actually becomes in resonance with different modes because of this effective redshift and blue shift of the modes inside the cavity. And so what happens is it actually interacts, so it doesn't exactly come into resonance with every mode like you would expect in the inertial case. But for short periods of time, it will come into resonance with each mode of the cavity when we let it evolve for long enough. And so the question is, could we use this to actually perform arbitrary quantum operations on the single detector? Now, the model that we used was the Unruh-DeWitt Hamiltonian, which is given by the monopole coupling to the field. We can rewrite it in this form, which is given in the proper reference frame of the detector, and the Minkowski modes of the cavity, but the detector has been parameterized in terms of the Rindler coordinates x and t. Okay. Now, can we use the rotating wave approximation? So for an inertial detector, we would expect that we could do this. For an accelerated detector, it turns out that the rotating wave terms, the sigma plus a Daeger and sigma minus a, actually contribute as at the same order as the counter-rotating terms at high accelerations and large times. So, no, we can't. What's the actual method we used? We looked at the first order perturbation of the time evolution operator U, and an initial state of the system as a pure state of the detector and a Fock state of the field. Then we let this evolve for a certain amount of time, and we traced out the field. Then we got this term rho, the initial state, plus a little term, a little bit, that's proportional to lambda squared. The order lambda terms dropped out because when you trace out the field, the interaction Hamiltonian, when you just apply it once, will bring everything off diagonal, or the mode terms off diagonal, and when you trace them out, they go away. If we applied second order perturbation theory, we would have a term that's proportional to lambda to the fourth, and the lambda cubed terms and lambda squared terms all drop away. Okay, so we can do some algebra and figure out that the change in the density matrix at order lambda squared is this, and it's given by the map with the AI and BI operators given down here, which are just proportional to these poly X and poly Y. What else do I want to say about that? That's pretty much it. So we've included every mode in the system, and you can imagine that this will give us some numerical problems, not only because the terms start oscillating really fast, but also because we have to include infinitely many of them. But when we do our actual computations, we cut it off at some point, that I'll explain in a little bit, using this error bound here. And letting us cutting it off at some point lets us just consider a finite number of them, and so we can actually compute it numerically. So the I plus minus that you saw in the definitions of these AI and BI are these integrals here. And you can tell that initially they're pretty ugly and oscillate really quickly. But when we expand it and simplify and do a change of variables, we end up with these integrals. One of them oscillates very quickly. It's proportional to this e to the theta, which goes from 0 to at. And e to the minus in this one oscillates slowly, because it's e to the minus theta. Then when we actually want to do these integrals, this one the computer can't really handle, so we cut it off at some point using this lemma, the van der Kerpoot lemma, which in our case simplifies here. And this guy we can actually numerically compute. Okay, and then after some point, we'll have to cut off a bunch of modes, as I said. And so the error for not including all of the modes is given by this formula here. And you can tell for infinite acceleration and very, very long times, it actually blows up. But at finite accelerations and finite times, it actually decays as 1 over n to the 4. The intuition that we've been using is sort of this naive approximation that the effective frequency of the detector is given by omega e to the theta, and then omega e to the minus theta for this term, and omega e to the theta for this term. And so they will interact with all the modes of the cavity if you let it evolve for long enough. But at finite times, we can consider it only interacting with a few modes of them. Okay. Now, where do we go from there? So we looked at a state that's initially on the Bloch sphere, and then that's given by these formulae here, and then looked at the sort of tangent plane to the Bloch sphere and checked how the change in the change in the vector happens. So these are all at order lambda squared, as it's the change in the density matrix. And you can see that it's sort of a rotation in this angle delta that's given by the phase difference in the I plus minus, and then proportional to the mode occupation, m, and of course the magnitude of the integrals, r plus and r minus. And then from there we can come up, So what about decoherence? Of course we're going to introduce decoherence when we do this. We're applying a non-unitary operation to the system, and then tracing out some environment, which corresponds to a non-unitary operation, and so we do get some decoherence. Our Bloch vector will slowly decay to the center. But as it turns out, the change of angles, or the change on the surface of the Bloch sphere, is an order of magnitude larger than the change in the actual length of the Bloch vector. So we do have some luck in that we won't decay right away to the center, and we could possibly move along the top. Some future work that we will do, or we will look at into probably after this conference, is looking at how to minimize the decoherence. So one idea would be to look at the coherent states, or even eigenstates of the interaction Hamiltonian. These should minimize entanglement to the environment and allow us to have less decoherence. Okay, so how do we actually look at this and analyze what's going on? So in the tangent plane to the Bloch sphere, we have the coordinates theta hat and phi. We have the coordinates theta hat and phi hat, and we can look at the change along those axes. So here I've looked at the change along the theta hat axis in the positive direction, which is towards the south pole of the Bloch sphere, and the change in the negative direction, which is towards the north pole, or the excited state of the detector. And what you can see is we can always move to the south pole, that's no problem. And if we're in the northern hemisphere, we can move towards the north or towards the excited state. And if we're in the south side of the hemisphere, we can always move towards the equator. However, we do have some problem here right at the equator where this goes to zero, and it's currently what we're looking into right now. The parameters in these plots that I've used is on resonance and for accelerations in 0 to 4 and t 0 to 10. Order 1 accelerations is, like, I think, 10 to the 12 meters per second squared. 10 to the 16? Okay. 10 to the 16 meters per second squared. And the change in these angles are actually optimized over each of the accelerations and times. So the plot, the axis here is theta, this is phi, and each point on this plot represents a point on the Bloch sphere. Sorry, I should have mentioned that. Same with these. Okay. Now, what about the inertial case? So the detector, if we have a detector in the vacuum that's not moving, we know that it can always emit a photon and decay to the ground state. However, if we want to move towards the excited state, we tend to run into problems. So if we're in the northern hemisphere, it not only can't stay there, it actually starts decaying down to the ground state. And then if you're in the southern hemisphere of the Bloch sphere, you can move north to the equator, but no further. Okay, now what if we want to compare the inertial case to the accelerated case? Still looking at the vacuum, by the way. So there's no photons inside our cavity to interact with. The only interactions that we see are from the vacuum and from the accelerating the detector. Here we plotted the difference in the angles along the theta hat axis, which is this will be the way you could decay down to the south pole, and you can see that it's always bigger for the accelerated case. So if this plot's positive, it means that the accelerated detector can always beat the inertial detector when we want to move further in the Bloch sphere. And it's the same when we minimize over this, so we want to move towards the north pole, the accelerated detector always beats the inertial detector. So that's great news. And then another thing we can do is look at these operators AI and BI, and if we set MI equal to 0, we see that this BI term goes away, and all we're left with is this coefficient on sigma x and another coefficient on sigma y, and it turns out the magnitudes of those, so if you look at the magnitude of the poly x operator over the magnitude of the coefficient over the magnitude coefficient of the poly y, it actually diverges for large accelerations. So this increases linearly with acceleration and then some sort of periodicity with time. And then this is just the inverse, the difference of the two terms over the sum. Okay. So our objective was to do single qubit quantum operations by carefully choosing paths through space. What we've looked at here is just the particle detector accelerating longitudinally through the cavity, and we've seen that we can move in either north or south, and I haven't shown the plots here, but we can also move in the azimuthal direction along phi, and that's no problem. We can always move forward or backward. And we can also apply two elements from the algebra, poly x's and poly y's. And now, what about future work? Still a few more weeks here. We'd like to look at arbitrary movement through time-dependent acceleration, transverse motion, possibly transversely to the cavity, and then, well, curved space times, that's a little ambitious, but, you know, we would like to look at that. We'd also like to move to the continuum, possibly look at two particle detectors inside the cavity and see if we can apply like the C-naught gate, and then try to minimize decoherence using eigenstates of the interaction Hamiltonian. Thank you all for listening.
Are there any questions?
Maybe I missed something. I didn't quite understand why, in the inertial case, you couldn't move in the northern hemisphere towards the pole. Aren't you getting Rabi oscillations?
We get Rabi oscillations, but that only keeps us in the southern hemisphere. In order to get above the equator, we'd have to add photons into the cavity.
Yeah, well, there are several questions. Nick, do you have a powerful voice?
Have you thought about a different coupling?
No. We've only considered just small diameter coupling. Or do you mean other than the monopole coupling?
Other than the monopole, that coupling is something else.
No, I haven't.
Because it seems like, even if you just switched the sigma to something else, it would change the axis.
That's a brilliant idea. So there were two questions there.
So maybe this is a silly question, but how do you keep the spin from leaving the cavity?
From which?
Leaving the cavity, it's moving on.
Oh, yeah, okay. So if we have high acceleration and we apply it for long times, we will leave the cavity. But exercise for leaving the cavity. We could think of preparing mini cavities with mini particle detectors that are all accelerating, and this particle detector would prepare the field for this one, and vice versa until we go all the way on and consider times long enough.
Does that affect decoherence at all?
Yeah, so longer times, we usually have more decoherence.
I mean, being in multiple different cavities,
right? I don't think so, because it's the same interaction Hamiltonian and same sign term inside this periodic with the cavities. So,
German.
Could you sketch a space-time diagram of what your cavity does and what your detector
does? Sure. So. Detector here, 1 over A, and then cavity, length L, and then this is sort of, the Findlay coordinates. The detector would come in from positive infinity and stop at the beginning of the detector and then accelerate up. And, these guys, keep looking at more of them. So the detector, the walls of the detector here. Is that clear? No?
The detector doesn't come from the infinity. You start at time equals zero, you put the detector there. Basically what he wrote, right?
Yeah, the detector starts at the beginning of the cavity and then accelerates there.
That's okay, last question, and then we say goodbye.
No.
Well,
I don't know.
We can discuss it later. That's a good question. Okay. So let's thank again the speaker.